We got hundreds of nominations for a Tell the Story of New York in 10 Objects contest. The votes are in, and for the last 2 weeks, we have been counting down the items that you selected. Here to talk about the nominations and the results are Sarah Henry, Chief Curator of the Museum of the City of New York, and Ellen Lupton, the Senior Curator of Contemporary Design at Cooper Hewitt. And I'm very pleased to welcome both of them to our show today. Hello.
Delighted to be here.
Hi there.
It's very hard to sum up several hundred years of history in just a few items. Sarah, do you think that our 10 winning objects are a good representation?
Well, as you say, it's just about an impossibility. In a lot of ways, they hit on a lot of great themes in New York City history. You get the story of New York's diversity captured in that Greek coffee cup. You touch on the themes of its economy and kind of the opportunity that drives the history. It's interesting, I think, that people were very kind of nostalgic for the second half of the 20th century. So I thought that there was an interest expressed in what people remember about a lost New York that's still within their living memory, which makes a lot of sense.
Listeners nominated a wide range of objects for the contest that didn't make the top 10. Ellen, did anything in particular jump out at you?
Oh, yeah. I was thrilled to see so much graphic design in the list of winners as well as nominees. Classics like the Velvet Underground LP cover from 1967.
The one with the banana, the removable banana.
Yeah.
Andy Warhol.
Yeah, what a great icon.
The nominations range from slightly abstract concepts like star architecture to the very tangible and sometimes unpleasant. One listener suggested filled black garbage bags. What'd you think of that?
Well, I think that is, an icon of the city. And a lot of the submissions looked at kind of the darker side, like the no radio signs that people used to put in their cars to deter thieves,
Yeah, it's interesting. I think there's a kind of a fascination with, again, history that's about 20, 30 years old at a time when the city had a character that's still on the airwaves everywhere about, a kind of grittier city in some ways, one that we think was more authentic maybe. But this, certainly I don't think anyone would say the piles of garbage bags represent the city today. So it's kind of a remembered post-war city.
So the 70s, which represent a very negative view of New York, crime, drugs, et cetera, we still have a certain nostalgia for
it. Well, I think that there is a sense that there were negative things about that period, but there's also a vitality that people are nostalgic for. And people also remember the things that shaped their lives in the city, especially longtime New Yorkers.
Well, someone going way back, nominated Peter Stuyvesant's peg leg. Do we have any idea where that particular object is?
No, I don't think that we do. But it is interesting to hearken back to the Dutch origins of the city, because that's obviously something we think about a lot at the Museum of the City of New York, and the degree to which this character, the city that we know today, you can see aspects of it going all the way back.
The names of places.
Even in the names of places, yes.
The 10th object, the final one on our list, is the subway map. And how important is the subway to understanding the way New York looks and is today?
Well, I would say as a historian, and then we can talk about the design, which I think is the graphic part of that. This to me, the fact that the subway map was chosen and also the subway token was really right spot on, because if you want to understand what makes New York, New York, which includes its diversity and its density, our ability to live together the way that we do, it's really the subway that makes New York as we know it possible. So anything that speaks to the subway, I'm all in favor of that.
Well, Sarah mentioned, Ellen, that the token was also chosen. It actually was chosen as the second most popular thing. It's interesting that the subway map, which is still with us, I want to get to the token later, but that the subway map, which is still with us and is so important to us and especially to tourists, winds up number 10, and the token, which is no longer with us, is number 2.
Well, that's nostalgia for you.
Does the way certain subway lines were drawn decades ago still influence the way the city is continuing to develop? Ellen?
Well, I think the way the map has become an icon of the city
All of the different redesigns?
Yeah. So in 1972, the great Italian designer Massimo Vignelli was commissioned to create a radically modern subway map design that instead of showing geography at all, it just showed the connection between the different routes. And New York City was not ready for that. Mm-hmm. Other cities had done it. London had done it, you know, 50 years earlier.
Paris.
Tokyo did it. Paris, right.
Well, it reflects, though, something really particular about the way New York's grew and the way the subway system grew, because we actually had a program on this up at the Museum of the City of New York, and Vignelli was there, and John Tarnack and others. And it was pointed out that, you know, New York City doesn't have a subway system.
We have
three subway systems. It grew up as three subway systems, and that is reflected in the complexity of the layout and creates a great challenge for designers of maps.
Well, Ellen, do you have a favorite map, a favorite version?
Oh, well, the Vignelli map is a classic. It's in my museum's collection. Mm-hmm. It is much loved by graphic designers. And I think one of the reasons we love it is because it had such a hard time, you know.
It got battered about.
It was an embattled object.
What about today's map?
Well, I think it works perfectly fine, but if you really look at it, you see that it's full of distortions as well. It's not... Mm-hmm. Geographically accurate. It puts the island in a kind of true north position. Right. It makes Central Park much more square and squat than it actually is. Mm-hmm. And that's in order to accommodate the information. And that's what maps do. They're not really accurate to geography. They have a purpose.
And the Vignelli map was really not a map. It was a diagram. And
But how is that all that different from the Mercator map, which kind of distorts the world? After all, we live on a globe,
right,
and we're flattening everything out. In this case, we live in a very complicated geographic situation, and as Ellen said, have to get a lot of information in.
Right, and it's always a kind of battle between clarity and completeness. And so the clearer you make something and the simpler it is, the easier it is to read, but the less complete. And it lacks information about actually the real, true physical relationship among things. And it really lacked. Vignelli completely lacked the above-ground story. So there wasn't that orientation of the physical city on the surface.
The ninth object on the list is Manhattan Schist, which is the layer of rock that's underneath the city. And we have the listener who nominated Schist on the line, Seth Rove. Seth, of all the things, why did you nominate Schist?
I just thought it was a different kind of object, which it's part of the geology of New York, so it's actually part of the city itself. But it's also been used as an object to help put the city together, and it relates to the city at really countless different levels.
How important has the bedrock underneath Manhattan been to the development of the city? We wouldn't have our skyline, would we?
It's a geological map of where they decided to put the skyscrapers, because as kind of a foundational material, it's much cheaper to build the skyscrapers over the bedrock, where the bedrock was shallowest. So when you look at the skyline, you're looking at that map.
We used to broadcast out of the municipal building, which is right on the edge of the downtown Schist, I'm told.
Mm-hmm.
They McKim, Mead & White designed it to be much taller, but then they discovered that the northern part of the building was not on Schist, and they had to adjust the whole thing while they were building it.
Right.
Ellen, we got a few nominations that were specific buildings and structures, like the Chrysler Building. Do the different styles of architecture in New York reflect the social and economic changes in the city? Would they even be possible, as Seth pointed out, if we didn't have the Schist?
Yeah, I guess not, and they certainly reflect the different styles, the way money chose to express itself at different points in history. You know, something like the Empire State Building that was such an exemplar of the Art Deco style, but also a kind of symbol of the end of an era economically.
And thinking about Schist, we also ought not just to treat it as bedrock, something that goes under the built environment, but remember that it rises to the surface in Manhattan. And the island whose name Manhattan meant island of many hills, you can see the bedrock, you can see the schist emerging, particularly in the upper echelons or the upper reaches of Manhattan. And it really, it shaped the nature not only of the environment that the human habitation takes place on, but the way that the urban development proceeded.
Now, Chicago has many skyscrapers. Does it have a schist as well? You don't
I
know.
I have no idea.
I don't know.
Seth, you're in the process of becoming an architect. What happens if you want to build in Chicago?
It's very possible to do. They just dig very deep pylons down into the ground, and it's actually held up by friction.
But Manhattan schist makes it easier.
It's a lot cheaper and easier to do it here, which is why they don't bother to build the skyscrapers in those other parts of Manhattan.
It also gives some of the character of the city as we walk around, because Manhattan schist is mixed into the sidewalks, and the mica that's in that metamorphic rock glitters, you know, on a sunny day. So we see it even when we don't realize we see it.
We're also seeing it in buildings. I mean, when they excavated the subways, a lot of that stone was reused as cladding material for buildings. City College, where I studied, the old campus is all a subway excavated schist.
St. Paul's.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for participating, Seth.
Yeah, you're very welcome.
We are talking about the 10 objects that our listeners, our listeners proposed many objects that the 10 that our listeners have chosen as the ones most representative of New York. You may disagree, but it's a wonderful selection. Number 8 on our list is the Wall Street street sign. Mm-hmm. Although the sign might be considered iconic, I interpreted this object as representing the importance of finance and commerce in New York City. Ellen, do you see it that way?
Yeah, I think the sign itself is rather generic and not necessarily original. It looks like any other, you know, municipal street sign in the city, but it's really about the notion of a street coming to symbolize a whole economic system that's so important to New York and, of course, to the world.
And it's a reasonable choice to have picked the sign because, in a funny way, Wall Street itself is not all that recognizable visibly. You know, it's not that you have an image of the physical street. When you visualize Wall Street, what you think of are those institutions and that financial system. So the sign stands in for that as well as any other physical thing.
Because
except
I was
maybe
wondering,
the stock market itself.
I was wondering why the Times Square street sign wasn't nominated.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I guess Wall Street means something ultimately more significant than Times Square, or it's
yes,
the street
it's
sign.
The street itself, I think, the name of it, everything has become so important to people. And I'm sure there's countless tourists that take their picture in front of the Wall Street sign.
And it goes
whereas
back
at Times Square, you would look for something else, like, you know, a building or a flashing, more dramatic sign.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that the Wall Street sign and the rest of the city's public signage are particularly good examples of design?
I think it is pretty standard and similar to what you see in other cities.
Well, drivers will tell you that they are very confused when they come into the city.
Although we do have the grid, which does help orient them, at least in Manhattan, from above Houston Street. The other thing I wanted to say about Wall Street...
And the grid was nominated, although it didn't make the top 10.
It didn't make it. And if I had one to add to the list, it would be that. You know, we have an exhibition about this is the 200th anniversary of the Commissioner's Plan that laid out that street grid. And we have an exhibition at the Museum of the City of New York. And that really did... It's not only iconic, it's not only symbolic, it was transformative to the city itself.
My guests are Sarah Henry, Chief Curator of the Museum of the City of New York, and Ellen Lupton, the Senior Curator of Contemporary Design at Cooper Hewitt. And this is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. The seventh item is the Brooklyn Bridge, which violated our rule that these objects had to fit into a museum. But I'm guessing, Sarah, there's no way that you could have fit this into the Museum of the City.
I was hoping you weren't going to ask us to take it into our collection.
Anyway,
or certainly not to buy it.
It's
right?
Doing such a good job as it is. We wouldn't want to take it away from its real site.
Right.
But a lot of our listeners commented on how beautiful the bridge is. What makes it so aesthetically appealing to so many people?
You know, I think it's so appealing partly because it's been represented so beautifully by so many artists and photographers. I think the way we see it has as much to do with the beautiful imagery we associate with it. It's just inspired so many people to create these iconic images. And then, of course, the experience of the bridge itself, being on the bridge, is an amazing thing.
Well, I'm hoping they'll take all of that stuff off for while they that they're using to repair it to give us the full aesthetic experience it once again sometime in the future. We have Liz Titus on the line. She is a listener who nominated the bridge and a few other objects. Liz, why do you think the Brooklyn Bridge is important to understanding the history of New York?
Well, I did have a problem with the requirement that the bridge fit into the museum. But my idea was that instead of the bridge itself, you could have a sign that read, "Bridge for Sale."
Uh-huh. Well, we could put a scale model of the bridge into the museum.
We at the Museum of the City of New York, we have actual great artifacts from when the bridge was built, including a wrench, which was 6 feet long, that in order to turn those massive bolts.
But Liz, you are right. The bridge was important in helping incorporate New York City at the end of the 1800s.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And, well, my thought was playing off the saying that's quite common, if you believe that, I've got a bridge I'd like to sell you. And actually, since the bridge was completed in 1883, the idea of illegally selling it has become kind of a symbol of the power of good salesmanship. Possibly the gullible nature of man and greed and quick riches and not much work. Along with Wall Street and Bernie Madoff, you have the Brooklyn Bridge and the number one con artist of his time, George Parker.
Well, are you aware of how important the Brooklyn Bridge is in the minds of Italian tourists? Do you know that the most popular chewing gum in Italy is called Brooklyn Bridge?
Ah, yes.
And that's why you see so many Italian tourists going to see the Brooklyn Bridge. Mm-hmm. They've been chewing the gum and kind of imagining the source of the image.
Well, it was a feat of incredible engineering when it was built, for one thing, and a symbol of incredible ambition for the city. And we should say the cities, because at the time when it was built, New York and Brooklyn were two separate cities. So it was the twin cities that Emma Lazarus writes about in her poem, The New Colossus. Before Minneapolis and St. Paul, we were the twin cities, Brooklyn and New York. And the knitting together of these, as you say, Leonard, it's the first step in what's a growing momentum towards consolidating greater New York, which happens 15 years after the bridge is built.
Well, New Yorkers are likely to cross the bridge if they're going from Brooklyn to New York or to Manhattan or vice versa. But visiting the bridge is one of those things like going to the Statue of Liberty or the top of the Empire State Building that native New Yorkers don't necessarily do. It seems to have be more important in the minds of visitors.
Although
it's become one of the symbols of New York, do you think?
Yeah, although I think that now with the initiatives that have made it more accessible to pedestrians and to bicyclists, I think we experience the bridge on foot or on two wheels, even as New Yorkers, more often than maybe a generation ago. It took me well into my adult life, though, to cross the Brooklyn Bridge on foot.
Ellen, were you surprised that the Statue of Liberty and the Chrysler Building didn't make the cut?
Yes, yes. Although I think, you know, rightly so, the Statue of Liberty belongs to New Jersey, and we can't
claim that's fighting words. Remember the Statue of Liberty? No offense to the New Jersey, but the Statue of Liberty shows her back to New Jersey.
Well, it's a lovely back.
Well, I do think it's interesting that the Brooklyn Bridge is the one piece of really sort of heroic and monumental New York that made it on the list. Everything else, I guess you could consider schist heroic or monumental, but everything else really has to do more with the lived experience of ordinary people and less with the city as icon.
Now, we're going to go to a little break, but Liz, I understand that you are also an English professor. Were you surprised to see that Frank O'Hara's lunch poems came in at number 6 on our list?
No, I'm a former English teacher, but I wasn't surprised, and I think that that's a great choice.
And we'll come back to that as we continue this conversation about the top 10 items that define New York City. as chosen by our listeners. You can find out more information about the contest, the nominees, and the winners on our show page at WNYC.org. And my guests are Ellen Lupton, the Senior Curator of Contemporary Design at Cooper Hewitt, and Sarah Henry, Chief Curator of the Museum of the City of New York. Stay with us for more. And we are back with our guests, Ellen Lupton of the Cooper Hewitt Museum and Sarah Henry of the Museum of the City of New York. We're talking about the 10 objects that made the final cut in our contest of telling the story of New York in 10 objects, inspired by the 100 objects that the British Museum put together to talk about the history of the world. We think since New York is at the center of the world, we should celebrate it separately. And as I said earlier, the sixth selection was Frank O'Hara's Lunch Poems. Have you read them, Ellen?
I have not, but now I will.
What about you, Sarah?
Well, I've dipped into them, and it was for a very particular reason, because a couple of years ago we did an exhibition at the Museum of the City of New York. It was called Manhattan Noon, street photography by a young photographer named Gus Powell. And it was specifically inspired by Frank O'Hara's Lunch Poems, hence the title Manhattan Noon. And it was interesting because I believe that Gus Powell was born after Frank O'Hara died at his young age from a terrible accident. But this set of poems spoke to him across the generations.
The poems make many references to and meditate on New York City. Mm-hmm. In one poem, O'Hara imagines that a visiting Khrushchev would keep the Soviet Union from nuking New York City because he would be so overwhelmed by the beauty of the skyscrapers. It's interesting that the great early Soviet poet Vladimir Mayakovsky wrote a poem praising the Brooklyn Bridge.
Wow.
So New York has inspired poets all along.
Right.
And of course, Walt Whitman.
Absolutely. So there's wonderful poetry and literature from throughout New York City's history. O'Hara is interesting because it's not only about poetry, it was really about a cultural moment. So he was very embedded in the artistic world of the 1950s. He was part of the abstract expressionists art scene, the bebop jazz. It was, and his poetry really was like, it was a literary version of an abstract expressionist painting in a way. It was the New York School of Poetry, just like the New York School of Painting.
Number five on our list is an 18th century ship found at the World Trade Center site in 2010. And we have one of the archaeologists who worked on that excavation on the line right now, Elizabeth Mead. Hello.
Hi, Leonard. Thanks for having me.
Were you surprised to find a ship from the 1700s underneath the new World Trade Center?
Oh, definitely, because we've had sites that we've excavated where we were certain there were ships, and we dug them up and never found anything. So to find one where we weren't expecting one was quite a surprise, and it was very exciting.
Were you called in once the ship was discovered, or were you looking for something at the site?
No, my company, AKRF, is an environmental consulting firm, and we were working for the Port Authority and for the Lower Manhattan Development Corporation. So we'd been monitoring on the site for actually about a year and a half before the ship came up.
And this is what the Dutch did? They took old ships and used them as landfill?
The Dutch, any of the colonists, this particular ship probably dates to the late 18th century, so it wouldn't have been Dutch. But, all around the city and in other cities, it was a very common practice to take derelict vessels and bury them and just use them as structural support for new land.
Although it is interesting that they had this whole island of Manhattan to go to, and they were doing landfill.
Yeah. Well, they were doing landfill right from the Dutch when the Dutch arrived. They transformed the edge of New York. And it's not only to build more land, but also to make the edge of the city more usable, right, to build the piers, to build slips, and enable ships and commerce to take place.
Elizabeth, how much do we know about this ship and what its purpose was?
We know a fair amount. Some maritime archaeologists that we've worked with have identified it as a Hudson River sloop. So it would have been a merchant vessel probably that went up and down the Hudson River, bringing goods and people back and forth between the city and upstate New York. It could have gone great distances. We found shipworms on it, which suggests that it went to the Caribbean at some point. So it went all over the place and was likely used as a merchant vessel.
Thank you so much for talking with us.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
The fourth object on our countdown is also related to the harbor, the oyster, the only edible object on our list. A big surprise that the bagel didn't make the cut.
Right.
So why do you think, or a slice of pizza, Ellen, why do you think our listeners chose this food item over the bagel or a slice of pizza?
Well, I think it's because it's a natural resource. You know, pizza doesn't, you know, grow naturally in New York, despite its popularity. And the oyster is this ancient, amazing source of beauty and energy and taste that's actually a natural resource.
And we have Robert Malacuso on the line. He's the person who nominated the oyster. Hi, Robert.
Hi, Leonard.
What made you think of the oyster? Is it simply because you enjoy eating them?
I do enjoy eating them, but I also am an environmentalist and work for a college here in New Jersey, Brookdale Community College, and we've been involved in teaching marine science, and it's a perfect example of ecology and environment.
Well, there was a time when the whole New York Harbor was so filled with oysters that this was the greatest source of oysters in the world, and huge, weren't they, Sarah?
And I'm delighted this was chosen because it really gets us to think about New York's role geographically and its natural environment as well as its history as a seaport. We have this on the mind down at the South Street Seaport Museum these days very much, and this Eric Sanderson from the Wildlife Conservation Society, who did the project Manahata that reconstructed the island just before Henry Hudson arrived, has written a lot about the ways in which the setting of New York, of Manhattan Island, at the mouth of this great tidal estuary, created this incredible abundance. And the harbor was just alive with oysters. And they did start to decline. There's evidence that the Lenape Indians overfished the oysters and that they get smaller as their time goes by. And even by the early 19th century, they're starting to decline. But then they experienced a huge surge in the middle of the 19th century.
I wonder if the Lenape Indians used oyster sauce, some kind of ketchupy thing. Robert, have you been involved in the restoration of oysters?
Yes, I have, with the Baykeeper and also in Monmouth County, and also with in Ocean County, Reclam the Bay, who has put back over 2 million shellfish into Barnegat Bay.
I understand that Pearl Street got its name from the piles of oyster shells that lined the area.
Of course, the Dutch thought that the oyster here had oysters, pearls, but no pearls, our oysters.
How much cleaning it will be necessary to get the oysters, maybe not back to their former glory, but to make New York a source of edible oysters once again?
Well, I think the Baykeeper is really trying to bring attention to the environment and the oyster reefs that were once here that helped to clean the bay and get rid of some of the pollutants, and also to clean up some of the diatoms that cause red tides.
Although Mark Kalansky, who wrote a book on oysters, told one of my producers that harbor oysters would probably taste fine because PCBs don't have much of a taste. They don't have much flavor.
Bright side.
It's more about fecal coliforms and so on in the oysters that make them dangerous to eat.
Well, I'm glad you reminded me of that. Thank you so much for participating.
Sure. Thank you for having me.
We've come to the third object, and it's the food cart. Mm. Have food carts always been a feature of city life? Ellen, do you think that they're so popular in New York because people are constantly on the street and on the go?
Yeah, and I think what's interesting is they have come back more than ever and are becoming more diverse and, you know, more variety in the quality and types of food that you can get from a food cart. So I think it's an object that on the one hand is nostalgic and represents something of old New York, but it's also very much new New York.
Well, do you think that they go all the way back to push carts that the immigrants used to have, or is this just a continuation of the hot dog cart that we've known for so many years, Sarah?
Well, there's been outdoor selling in New York since the colonial period, and there's always also been a battle between those outdoor sellers and regulators and merchants who pay rent or own real estate, who resent the competition. And certainly the height of the pushcart era came in the early 20th century, and then Fiorello LaGuardia launched a campaign against them and brought the number of pushcarts down a lot. But it's come back. There's still
gourmet food carts.
Right, and the food truck, which is also its own category.
The second item ties into our 10th item. It's the subway token. We mentioned it earlier. Ellen, why do you think listeners chose the token? Why? It hasn't been used for decades. They didn't choose the MetroCard.
Well, the token is more of an icon. And again, I think it relates to this nostalgia that people love these objects from a different, you know, time that represent a less digital life. You know, and carrying those things around was really part of being a New Yorker, sorting them out from your change.
We actually have the listener who nominated the subway token on the line, Bill DeGrasso. Hi, Bill.
Hi, Leonard. How are you?
I'm okay. What led you to nominate the subway token of all the possible objects you could have chosen?
I think, well, first of all, I'm an international strap hanger. I've been on subways all over the world, and I think what Ellen just said is right. It is that artifact quality of the subway token. It's like a Roman coin. You know, it is something you'd find, you know, with a metal detector, I guess, you know, that kind of thing. And it, you're right, it is a little bit of a throwback, and it obviously has a New York stamped on it, what it's supposed to be for, and there's a value to it. You buy them, or you used to buy them. You know, and it means something to me. My first trip to New York when I was in my teens was 30 years ago, and we used subway to get around. And so that's a little special meaning, too.
Well, if you'd come to New York in the 40s, would you have nominated the nickel? It then went up to the dime, then it went up to 15 cents, right. And they actually used to have two slots on the subway where you put a dime and a nickel in. It went up to a quarter.
They brought the token in when the fare went up to 15 cents.
Oh, did they?
Yeah. And so, of course, the nickel fare was almost sacrosanct for decades in New York. And then it went up to the dime. And at the time when it went to 15 cents is when we got the token. So that was 1953. And the era of the token lasted for exactly 50 years.
And Ellen, what did you think of the design with that little cutout Y in the middle?
I always loved it. I thought it was a beautiful thing. I think that having that empty space was very, very cool and very distinctive, and also made it easier to tell just from feeling it that it wasn't a normal coin.
And, Bill, you didn't say, please swipe again after you put it in.
At this turnstile.
That's true. That's true. And I think also just because when you look at the subway system itself, or MTA in general, I mean, it's the one thing that brought all five boroughs together, more or less. And so that was also one of the reasons why I nominated it, too, because of what it, you know, the transit system in general, what it represents.
Thank you so much for participating. I feel like I should do a little fanfare now because we've gotten to number one. And it comes as a bit of a surprise. The Greek coffee cup. What do you think makes this object so special, Ellen?
Well, again, it's nostalgia. You know, before Starbucks took over the island, this was the cup that predominantly you drank your coffee in. And it, you know, was just a ubiquitous thing that I think none of us loved so much until it started to disappear.
Well, the coffee wasn't always so good.
I think it also hooks into the, you know, the great New York story of immigration and diversity, right? They marketed this cup. The reason it's a Greek coffee cup is because Greeks dominated the diner business.
When did that begin?
So, the cup itself was introduced in the mid-60s. So I think it was in the good part of the middle of the 20th century. But even after the ethnic succession really was underway and new immigrants were running both the diners and the corner delis, they kept buying the Greek coffee cup. So the Pakistanis and the Koreans all bought this because this was the symbol of, New York.
The object was nominated by several people, and we've asked two of them to join us, Sherry Mezoki and Mark Doerr. Hi, you're on the air. Sherry,
hi, how are you?
Why did you think the cup was important?
Well, I thought the cup was important because, like your speaker said, before Starbucks, it was ubiquitous, and everyone had it. And coffee is the thing that fuels the engine of the city that never sleeps. So everyone had it, and it didn't matter who you were, how much money you made. Everyone was always drinking coffee, and they all got it from these Greek diners, and they all drank it out of these same kinds of cups.
What about you, Mark?
For me, before I moved to New York, I would always see on TV and in movies people rushing down the street with the coffee cup in their hand or working late and all stressed out or a police officer drinking it on the corner. And then I come here, and I moved here.
Where did you come from?
I came from Illinois.
Mm-hmm. And they don't have anything like this?
They don't. They don't have street vendors, and every cup is different, so you don't really pay attention to the nice blue design that they have on the cup. And then you come here and you realize it's quintessential New York. It's invented by some guy that wasn't Greek. Certainly he was a Holocaust survivor, and he didn't really think twice about it, had no art training, and just invented this cup that became so popular.
Mm. It also became ubiquitous as a symbol of panhandling. You think that's what everybody would shake, and to the degree that there's now that they designed a beggar's purse in the shape of a Greek coffee cup, it was part of that whole 70s decline.
But Ellen, as Mark points out, it was not designed by a trained artist, which would suggest that sometimes the iconic design can come from an unexpected source.
Yeah, exactly. I think, again, we love it not so much because it's beautiful, but because of what it represents, that it became the sort of accidental icon of New York City coffee. And a professional designer maybe couldn't have done it any better.
And it turns out there's even a ceramic version of it. Mm-hmm. Sherry, do you still go to places where the cup is available?
Occasionally, yes. I actually was talking to a friend of mine today, and she was drinking it, so I thought that was pretty funny. But I sort of miss those coffee cups because I think they're sort of beautiful. And also I like the way they kind of represent like a great American success story, how like immigrants from all over the world come here and build these businesses. And you see it in every ethnicity, like Koreans with greengrocers or South Asians with newsstands. And they do this all over and over and over again, and they make our city a much more livable place.
Well, thank you both so much for participating.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
We're pretty much out of time, but I thought I'd ask you, Ellen and Sarah, if there were any objects that you thought should have made it to the top 10 but didn't.
Well, I was very surprised not to see the I Love New York logo by Milton Glaser. Mm-hmm. I think that is a professional piece of graphic design that for many people represents how we feel about New York.
Mm-hmm. You talk about the thing with the heart.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which has been stolen by an awful lot of people. It started with I Love New York, and now it's I Love Everything.
Love Everything, right.
Yeah.
I was interested, in the category of sort of standard icons, I guess I would have expected to see the yellow cab, the checker cab there, just because that's such an emblem of New York. But I also guess I would have liked to have seen a little more representation of the really vibrant diversity in the city because, so again, I think like a historian, I think about the events that took place, a turntable from the South Bronx in the 1970s would allow us to tell the story of the way that the birth of hip hop out of the worst time in the city's 20th century history, or one of the worst times, gave birth to a cultural movement that changed the globe. There there are ways in which the diversity of the city maybe quite wasn't quite captured.
Well, we still, I think, did pretty well.
Very well.
And I thank the both of you so much for enriching the experience. Sarah Henry is chief curator at the Museum of the City of New York. Ellen Lupton is the senior curator of contemporary design at Cooper Hewitt. And it's been a lot of fun. Thanks to all of our listeners who participated as well.
Thank you so much.